of Anacreon, which 2 centuries since gave itself up to brigandage, barbarism, and anarchy. There is no planet known as Foundation in the province, however. There was a vague reference to a group of scientists sent to that province just before its separation from our protection. They were to prepare an encyclopedia. He smiled thinly. I believe they called it the Encyclopedia Foundation. Well, the Emperor considered it somberly. That seems a tenuous connection to advance. I'm not advancing it, sire. No word was ever received from that expedition after the growth of anarchy in that region. If their descendants still live and retain their name, then they have reverted to barbarism, most certainly. And so he wants reinforcements. The Emperor bent a fierce glance at his secretary. This is most peculiar. To propose to fight savages with 10 ships and to ask for more before a blow is struck. And yet I begin to remember this Rios. He was a handsome boy of loyal family. Broderick, there are complications in this that I don't penetrate. There may be more importance in it than would seem. His fingers played idly with the gleaming sheet that covered his stiffened legs. He said, I need a man out there, one with eyes, brains, and loyalty. Broderick? The secretary bent a submissive head. And the ship, sire? Not yet. The Emperor moaned softly as he shifted his position in gentle stages. He pointed a feeble finger. Not till we know more. Convene the Council of Lords for this day week. It will be a good opportunity for the new appropriation as well. I'll put that through, or lives will end. He leaned his aching head into the soothing tingle of the force field pillow. Go now, Broderick, and send in the doctor. He's the worst bumbler of the lot. Chapter 5. The War Begins. From the radiating point of Siwenna, the forces of the Empire reached out cautiously into the black unknown of the periphery. Giant ships passed the vast distances that separated the vagrant stars at the galaxy's rim and felt their way around the outermost edge of Foundation influence. Worlds isolated in their new barbarism of 2 centuries felt the sensation once again of Imperial overlords upon their soil. Allegiance was sworn in the face of the massive artillery covering capital cities. Garrisons were left. Garrisons of men in Imperial uniform, with the spaceship and sun insignia upon their shoulders. The old men took notice and remembered once again the forgotten tales of their grandfathers' fathers, of the times when the universe was big and rich and peaceful, and that same spaceship and sun ruled all. Then the great ships passed on to weave their line of forward bases further around the Foundation, and as each world was knotted into its proper place in the fabric, the report went back to Belrios at the general headquarters he had established on the rocky barrenness of a wandering, sunless planet. Now Rios relaxed and smiled grimly at Dukembar. Well, what do you think, Patrician? I? Of what value are my thoughts? I'm not a military man. He took in with one wearily distasteful glance the crowded disorder of the rock-bound room, which had been carved out of the wall of a cavern of artificial air, light, and heat, which marked the single bubble of life in the vastness of a bleak world. For the help I could give you, he muttered, or would want to give you, you might return me to Siwenna. Not yet, not yet. The general turned his chair to the corner which held the huge, brilliantly transparent sphere that mapped the old imperial prefect of Anacreon and its neighboring sectors. Later, when this is over, you will go back to your books and to more. I'll see to it that the estates of your family are restored to you, and to your children for the rest of time. Thank you, said Barr with faint irony. But I lack your faith in the happy outcome of all this. Rios laughed sharply. Don't start your prophetic croakings again. This map speaks louder than all your woeful theories. He caressed its curved, invisible outline gently. Can you read a map in radial projection? You can? Well, here, see for yourself. The stars in gold represent the Imperial territories. The red stars are those in subjection to the Foundation, and the pink are those which are probably within the economic sphere of influence. Now watch. Rios's hand covered a rounded knob, and slowly an area of hard, white pinpoints changed into a deepening blue. Like an inverted cup, they folded about the red and the pink. Those blue stars have been taken over by my forces, said Rios with quiet satisfaction. And they still advance. No opposition has appeared anywhere, and the barbarians are quiet. And particularly, no opposition has come from Foundation forces. They sleep peacefully and well. You spread your force thinly, don't you? Asked Barr. As a matter of fact, said Rios, despite appearances, I don't. The key points which I garrison and fortify are relatively few, but they are carefully chosen. The result is that the force expended is small, but the strategic result is great. There are many advantages, more than would ever appear to anyone who hasn't made a careful study of spatial tactics. But it is apparent to anyone, for instance, that I can base an attack from any point in an enclosing sphere, and that when I am finished, it will be impossible for the Foundation to attack at flank or rear. I shall have no flank or rear with respect to them. This strategy of the previous enclosure has been tried before, notably in the campaigns of Loris VI, some 2,000 years ago, but always imperfectly, always with the knowledge and attempted interference of the enemy. This is different. The ideal textbook case? Barr's voice was languid and indifferent. Rios was impatient. You still think my forces will fail? They must. You understand that there is no case in military history where an enclosure has been completed, that the attacking forces have not eventually won, except where an outside navy exists in sufficient force to break the enclosure. If you say so. And you still adhere to your faith? Yes. Rio shrugged. Then do so. Barr allowed the angry silence to continue for a moment, then asked quietly, Have you received an answer from the Emperor? Rios removed a cigarette from a wall container behind his head, placed a filter tip between his lips, and puffed at a flame carefully. He said, You mean my request for reinforcements? It came, but that's all. Just the answer. No ships? None. I half expected that. Frankly, Patrician, I should never have allowed myself to be stampeded by your theories into requesting them in the first place. It puts me in a false light. Does it? Definitely. Ships are at a premium. The civil wars of the last two centuries have smashed up more than half of the Grand Fleet, and what's left is in pretty shaky condition. You know, it isn't as if the ships we build these days are worth anything. I don't think there's a man in the galaxy today who can build a first-rate hyperatomic motor. I knew that, said the Sewenian. His eyes were thoughtful and introspective. I didn't know that you knew it. So, His Imperial Majesty can spare no ships. Psychohistory could have predicted that. In fact, it probably did. I should say that Harry Seldon's dead hand wins the opening round. Rios answered sharply, I have enough ships as it is. Your Seldon wins nothing. Should the situation turn more serious, then more ships will be available. As yet, the Emperor does not know all the story. Indeed. What haven't you told him? Obviously, your theories. Rios looked sardonic. The story is, with all respect to you, inherently improbable. If developments warrant, if events supply me with proof, then, but only then, would I make out the case of mortal danger. And in addition, Rios drove on casually, the story, unbolstered by fact, has a flavor of lese majesté that could scarcely be pleasant to His Imperial Majesty. The old patrician smiled. You mean that telling him his august throne is in danger of subversion by a parcel of ragged barbarians from the ends of the universe is not a warning to be believed or appreciated? Then you expect nothing from him. Unless you count a special envoy as something. And why a special envoy? It's an old custom. A direct representative of the crown is present on every military campaign which is under government auspices. Really? Why? It's a method of preserving the symbol of personal imperial leadership in all campaigns. It's gained a secondary function of ensuring the fidelity of generals. It doesn't always succeed in that respect. You'll find that inconvenient, General. Extraneous authority, I mean. I don't doubt that. Rios reddened faintly. But it can't be helped. The receiver at the General's hand glowed warmly, and with an unobtrusive jar, the cylindered communication popped into its slot. Rios unrolled it. Good, this is it. Duquesne Barr raised a mildly questioning eyebrow. Rios said, You know we've captured one of these traitor people, alive, and with his ship intact. I've heard of it. Well, they've just brought him in, and we'll have him here in a minute. You keep your seat, Patrician. I want you here when I'm questioning him. It's why I asked you here today in the first place. You may understand him where I might miss important points. The door signal sounded, and a touch of the General's toe swung the door wide. The man who stood on the threshold was tall and bearded, wore a short coat of a soft, leathery plastic, with an attached hood shoved back on his neck. His hands were free, and if he noticed the men about him were armed, he did not trouble to indicate it. He stepped in casually and looked about with calculating eyes. He favored the general with a rudimentary wave of the hand and a half nod. "Your name?" demanded Rios crisply. "Lathan Devers." The trader hooked his thumbs into his wide and gaudy belt. "Are you the boss here?" "You are a trader of the Foundation?" "That's right. Listen, if you're the boss, you'd better tell your hired men here to lay off my cargo." The general raised his head and regarded the prisoner coldly. "Answer questions. Do not volunteer orders." "All right, I'm agreeable. But one of your boys blasted a 2-foot hole in his chest already by sticking his fingers where he wasn't supposed to." Rio shifted his gaze to the lieutenant in charge. "Is this man telling the truth? Your report rank had it that no lives were lost."
None were, sir." The lieutenant spoke stiffly, apprehensively. "At the time. There was later some disposition to search the ship, there having arisen a rumor that a woman was aboard. Instead, sir, many instruments of unknown nature were located, instruments which the prisoner claims to be his stock in trade. One of them flashed on handling, and the soldier holding it died."
The general turned back to the trader. "Does your ship carry atomic explosives?"
"Galaxy, no. What for? That fool grabbed an atomic puncher, wrong end forward, and set it maximum dispersion. You're not supposed to do that. Might as well point a newt gun at your head. I'd have stopped him if 5 men weren't sitting on my chest."
Rios gestured at the waiting guard. "You go. The captured ship is to be sealed against all intrusion. Sit down, Devers." The trader did so, in the spot indicated, and withstood stolidly the hard scrutiny of the Imperial General and the curious glance of the Suenian patrician. Rios said, "You're a sensible man, Devers."
"Thank you. Are you impressed by my face, or do you want something?
Tell you what, though, I'm a good businessman."
"It's about the same thing. You surrendered your ship when you might have decided to waste our ammunition and have yourself blown to electron dust. It could result in good treatment for you if you continue that sort of outlook on life."
"Good treatment is what I mostly crave, boss."
"Good. And cooperation is what I mostly crave."
Rio smiled and said in a low aside to Duke Embar, "I hope the word crave means what I think it does. Did you ever hear such a barbarous jargon?" Devers said blandly,
"Right, I check you. But what kind of cooperation are you talking about, boss? To tell you straight, I don't know where I stand."
He looked about him.
"Where's this place, for instance? What's the idea?"
I've neglected the other half of the introductions. I apologize." Rios was in good humor.
"That gentleman is Duke Embar, patrician of the Empire. I am Bel Rios, peer of the Empire, and general of the third class in the armed forces of His Imperial Majesty."
The trader's jaw slackened. Then,
"The Empire? The old Empire they taught us about at school?" "Funny. I always had the sort of notion that it didn't exist anymore."
"Look about you. It does," said Rios grimly.
"Might have known it, though." And Lathan Devers pointed his beard at the ceiling. "That was a mightily polished-looking set of craft that took my tub. No kingdom of the periphery could have turned them out."
His brow furrowed.
"So what's the game, boss? Or do I call you general?"
"The game is war. Empire versus Foundation, that it?"
"Right." "Why?"
"I think you know why." The trader stared sharply and shook his head. Rios let the other deliberate, then said softly,
"I'm sure you know why."
Lathan Devers muttered,
"Warm here,"
and stood up to remove his hooded jacket. Then he sat down again and stretched his legs out before him.
He said comfortably, "I figure you're thinking I ought to jump up with a whoop and lay about me. I can catch you before you could move if I choose my time, and this old fellow who sits here and doesn't say anything couldn't do much to stop me."
"But you won't," said Rios confidently.
"I won't," agreed Devers amiably. "First off, killing you wouldn't stop the war, I suppose. There are more generals where you came from."
"Very accurately calculated. Besides which, I'd probably be slammed down about 2 seconds after I got you and killed fast. Or maybe slow, depending. But I'd be killed. And I never like to count on that when I'm making plans. It doesn't pay off."
"I said you were a sensible man.
But there's one thing I would like, boss. I'd like you to tell me what you mean when you say I know why you're jumping us."
"I don't. And guessing games bother me no end."
"Yes?"
"Ever hear of Harry Seldon?"
"No, I said I don't like guessing games."
Rios flicked a side glance at Dukembar, who smiled with a narrow gentleness and resumed his inwardly dreaming expression. Rios said with a grimace, "Don't you play games, Devers. There is a tradition, or a fable, or sober history, I don't care what, upon your foundation, that eventually you will found the Second Empire. I know quite a detailed version of Harry Seldon's psycho-historical claptrap, and your eventual plans of aggression against the Empire." "That so?" Devers nodded thoughtfully. "And who told you all that?" "Does that matter?" said Rios with dangerous smoothness. "You're here to question nothing. I want what you know about the Seldon fable." But if it's a fable, don't play with words, Devers." "I'm not. In fact, I'll give it to you straight. You know all I know about it. It's silly stuff, half-baked. Every world has its yarns. You can't keep it away from them. Yes, I've heard that sort of talk. Seldon, Second Empire, and so on. They put kids to sleep at night with this stuff. The young squirts curl up in the spare rooms with their pocket projectors and suck up Seldon thrillers. But it's strictly non-adult. Non-intelligent adult, anyway." The traitor shook his head. The Imperial General's eyes were dark. "Is that really so? You waste your lies, man. I've been on the planet Terminus. I know your foundation. I've looked it in the face. And you ask me? Me? When I haven't kept foot on it for 2 months at a piece in 10 years? You are wasting your time. But go ahead with your war, if it's fables you're after." And Barr spoke for the first time mildly. "You are so confident, then, that the Foundation will win?" The traitor turned. He flushed faintly, and an old scar on one temple showed whitely. The silent partner. How'd you squeeze that out of what I said, Doc?" Rios nodded very slightly at Barr, and the Sowenian continued in a low voice. "Because the notion would bother you if you thought your world might lose this war and suffer the bitter reapings of defeat, I know. My world once did, and still does." Lathan Devers fumbled his beard, looked from one of his opponents to the other, then laughed shortly. "Does he always talk like that, boss?" "Listen," he grew serious. "What's defeat? I've seen wars and I've seen defeats. What if the winner does take over? Who's bothered? Me? Guy like me?" He shook his head in derision. "Get this," the traitor spoke forcefully and earnestly. "There are 5 or 6 fat slobs who usually run an average planet. They get the rabbit punch, but I'm not losing peace of mind over them, see? The people, the ordinary runner guys, sure, some get killed and the rest pay extra taxes for a while, but it settles itself out, it runs itself down, and then it's the old situation again with a different 5 or 6. Dukembar's nostrils flared, and the tendons of his old right hand jerked, but he said nothing. Lathan Devers' eyes were on him. They missed nothing. He said, "Look, I spend my life in space for my 5 and dime gadgets and my beer and pretzel kickback from the combines. There's fat fellas back there," his thumb jerked over his shoulder and back, "that sit home and collect my year's income every minute out of skimmings for me and more like me. Suppose you run the Foundation. You'll still need us. You'll need us more than ever the combines do, because you'd not know your way around, and we could bring in the hard cash. We'd make a better deal with the Empire. Yeah, we would. And I'm a man of business. If it adds up to a plus mark, I'm for it." And he stared at the two with sardonic belligerence. The silence remained unbroken for minutes, and then a cylinder rattled into its slot. The general flipped it open, glanced at the neat printing, and in-circuited the visuals with a sweep. "Prepare plan indicating position of each ship in action. Await orders on full-arm defensive." He reached for his cape. As he fastened it about his shoulders, he whispered in a stiff-lipped monotone to Barr, "I'm leaving this man to you. I'll expect results. This war and I can be cruel to failures. Remember." He left, with a salute to both. Lathan Devers looked after him. "Well, something's hit him where it hurts. What goes on?" "A battle, obviously," said Barr gruffly. "The forces of the Foundation are coming out for their first battle. You'd better come along." There were armed soldiers in the room. Their bearing was respectful, and their faces were hard. Devers followed the proud old Sowenian patriarch out of the room. The room to which they were led was smaller, barer. It contained 2 beds, a visi-screen, and shower and sanitary facilities. The soldiers marched out, and the thick door boomed hollowly shut. "Hm." Devers stared disapprovingly about. This looks permanent.
It is, said Barr shortly. The old Siwenian turned his back. The trader said irritably, What's your game, Doc?
I have no game. You're in my charge, that's all.
The trader rose and advanced. His bulk towered over the unmoving patrician.
Yes? But you're in this cell with me, and when you were marched here, the guns were pointed just as hard at you as at me. Listen, you were all boiled up about my notions on the subject of war and peace.
He waited fruitlessly.
All right, let me ask you something. You said your country was licked once. By whom? Comet people from the outer nebulae?
Barr looked up. By the Empire.
That's so. Then what are you doing here?
Barr maintained an eloquent silence. The trader thrust out a lower lip and nodded his head slowly. He slipped off the flat-linked bracelet that hugged his right wrist and held it out.
What do you think of that?
He wore the mate to it on his left. The Siwenian took the ornament. He responded slowly to the trader's gesture and put it on. The odd tingling at the wrist passed away quickly.
Devers' voice changed at once.
Right, Doc, you got the action now. Just speak casually. If the room is wired, they won't get a thing. That's a field of story you've got there. Genuine Mallow design. Sells for 25 credits on any world from here to the outer rim. You get it free. Hold your lips still when you talk and take it easy. You gotta get the trick of it.
Duken Barr was suddenly weary. The trader's boring eyes were luminous and urging. He felt unequal to their demands.
Barr said, What do you want?
The words slurred from between unmoving lips.
I've told you. You make mouth noises like what we call a patriot. Yet your own world has been smashed up by the Empire. And here you are playing ball with the Empire's fair-haired general.
Doesn't make sense, does it?
Barr said, I have done my part. A conquering Imperial Viceroy is dead because of me.
That's so. Recently?
40 years ago.
40 years ago. The words seemed to have meaning to the trader. He frowned.
That's a long time to live on memories. Does that young squirt in the general's uniform know about it?
Barr nodded. Devers' eyes were dark with thought.
You want the Empire to win?
And the old Siwenian patrician broke out in a sudden deep anger.
May the Empire and all its works perish in universal catastrophe. All Siwenna prays that daily. I had brothers once, a sister, a father. But I have children now, grandchildren. The general knows where to find them.
Devers waited. Barr continued in a whisper.
But that would not stop me if the results in view warranted the risk. They would know how to die.
The trader said gently, You killed a viceroy once, huh?
You know, I recognize a few things. We once had a mayor, Hober Mallow his name was. He visited Siwenna. That's your world, isn't it? He met a man named Barr.
Duken Barr stared hard, suspiciously.
What do you know of this?
What every trader on the Foundation knows. You might be a smart old fella put in here to get on my right side. Sure, they'd point guns at you, and you'd hate the Empire and be all out for its smashing. Then I'd fall all over you and pour out my heart to you, and wouldn't the general be pleased?
There's not much chance of that, Doc.
But just the same, I'd like to see you prove that you're the son of Onum Barr of Siwenna, the sixth and youngest to escape the massacre.
Duken Barr's hand shook as he opened the flat metal box in a wall recess.
The metal object he withdrew clanked softly as he thrust it into the trader's hands.
Look at that, he said.
Devers stared. He held the swollen central link of the chain close to his eyes and swore softly.
That's Mallow's monogram, or I'm a space-struck rookie.
And the design is 50 years old if it's a day. He looked up and smiled.
Shake, Doc. A man-sized atomic shield is all the proof I need.
And he held out his large hand. Chapter 6. The Favorite. The tiny ships had appeared out of the vacant depths and darted into the midst of the armada. Without a shot or a burst of energy, they weaved through the ship-swollen area, then blasted on and out, while the Imperial wagons turned after them like lumbering beasts. There were two noiseless flares that pinpointed space as two of the tiny gnats shriveled in atomic disintegration, and the rest were gone. The great ships searched, then returned to their original task, and world by world, the great web of the enclosure continued. Broderick's uniform was stately, carefully tailored and as carefully worn.
His walk through the gardens of the obscure planet Wanda, now temporary Imperial headquarters, was leisurely. His expression was somber. Belrios walked with him, his field uniform open at the collar, and doleful in its monotonous gray-black. Rios indicated the smooth black bench under the fragrant tree fern, whose large, spatulate leaves lifted flatly against the white sun. "See that, sir? It is a relic of the Imperium. The ornamented benches, built for lovers, linger on, fresh and useful, while the factories and the palaces collapse into unremembered ruin." He seated himself while Cleon II's privy secretary stood erect before him and clipped the leaves above neatly with precise swings of his ivory staff. Rios crossed his legs and offered a cigarette to the other. He fingered one himself as he spoke. "It is what one would expect from the enlightened wisdom of His Imperial Majesty to send so competent an overseer as yourself. It relieves any anxiety I might have felt that the press of more important and more immediate business might perhaps force into the shadows a small campaign on the periphery." "The eyes of the Emperor are everywhere," said Roderick mechanically. "We do not underestimate the importance of the campaign. Yet still it would seem that too great an emphasis is being placed upon its difficulty. Surely their little ships are no such barrier that we must move through the intricate preliminary maneuver of an enclosure." Rios flushed, but he maintained his equilibrium. "I cannot risk the lives of my men, who are few enough, or the destruction of my ships, which are irreplaceable, by a too rash attack. The establishment of an enclosure will quarter my casualties in the ultimate attack, howsoever difficult it be. The military reasons for that I took the liberty to explain yesterday." This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Well, I am not a military man. In this case, you assure me that what seems patently and obviously right is in reality wrong. We will allow that. Yet your caution shoots far beyond that. In your second communication, you requested reinforcements. And these, against an enemy poor, small, and barbarous, with whom you have had no one skirmish at the time. To desire more forces under the circumstances would savor almost of incapacity or worse, had not your earlier career given sufficient proof of your boldness and imagination. "I thank you," said the general coldly. "But I would remind you that there is a difference between boldness and blindness. There is a place for a decisive gamble when you know your enemy and can calculate the risks at least roughly. But to move at all against an unknown enemy is boldness in itself. You might as well ask why the same man sprints safely across an obstacle course in the day and falls over the furniture in his room at night." Broderick swept away the other's words with a neat flirt of the fingers. "Dramatic, but not satisfactory. You have been to this barbarian world yourself. You have, in addition, this enemy prisoner you coddle, this traitor. Between yourself and the prisoner, you are not in a night fog. No? I pray you to remember that a world which has developed in isolation for 2 centuries cannot be interpreted to the point of intelligent attack by a month's visit. I am a soldier, not a cleft-chinned, barrel-chested hero of a subetheric trimensional thriller. Nor can a single prisoner, and one who is an obscure member of an economic group which has no close connection with the enemy world, introduce me to all the inner secrets of enemy strategy. You have questioned him? I have. Well, it has been useful, but not vitally so. His ship is tiny, of no account. He sells little toys, which are amusing, if nothing else. I have a few of the cleverest, which I intend sending to the Emperor as curiosities. Naturally, there is a good deal about the ship and its workings, which I do not understand. But then I am not a tech man. But you have among you those who are, pointed out Broderick. I, too, am aware of that, replied the General in faintly caustic tones. But the fools have so far to go before they could meet my needs. I have already sent for clever men who can understand the workings of the odd atomic field circuits the ship contains. I have received no answer. Men of that type cannot be spared, General. Surely there must be one man of your vast province who understands atomics. Were there such a one, I would have him heal the limping, invalid motors that power 2 of my small fleet of ships. 2 ships of my meager 10 that cannot fight the major battle for lack of sufficient power supply. 1/5 of my force condemned to the carrying activity of consolidating positions behind the lines. The secretary's fingers fluttered impatiently. Your position is not unique in that respect, General. The Emperor has similar troubles. The General threw away his shredded, never-lit cigarette, lit another, and shrugged. Well, it is beside the immediate point, this lack of first-class tech men. Except that I might have made more progress with my prisoner, were my psychic probe in proper order. The secretary's eyebrows lifted. You have a probe? An old one. A superannuated one, which fails me the one time I needed it. I set it up during the prisoner's sleep and received nothing. So much for the probe. I tried it on my own men, and the reaction is quite proper. But again, there is not one among my staff of tech men who can tell me why it fails upon the prisoner. Duke Embar, who is a theoretician of parts, though no mechanic, says the psychic structure of the prisoner may be unaffected by the probe, since from childhood he has been subjected to alien environments and neural stimuli. I don't know, but he may yet be useful. I save him in that hope. Broderick leaned on his staff. I shall see if a specialist is available in the capital. In the meanwhile, what of this other man you just mentioned, this Siwenian? You keep too many enemies in your good graces. He knows the enemy. He, too, I keep for future reference and the help he may afford me. But he is a Siwenian and the son of a proscribed rebel. He is old and powerless, and his family acts as hostage. I see. Yet I think that I should speak to this traitor myself. Certainly. Alone, the secretary added coldly, making his point. Certainly, repeated Rios blandly. As a loyal subject of the Emperor, I accept his personal representative as my superior. However, since the traitor is at the permanent base, you will have to leave the front areas at an interesting moment. Yes? Interesting in what way? Interesting in that the enclosure is complete today. Interesting in that within the week, the 20th Fleet of the Border advances inward towards the core of resistance. Rio smiled and turned away. In a vague way, Broderick felt punctured. Chapter 7. Bribery. Sergeant Maury Look made an ideal soldier of the ranks. He came from the huge agricultural planets of the Pleiades, where only army life could break the bond to the soil and the unavailing life of drudgery, and he was typical of that background. Unimaginative enough to face danger without fear, he was strong and agile enough to face it successfully. He accepted orders instantly, drove the men under him unbendingly, and adored his general unswervingly. And yet with that, he was of a sunny nature. If he killed a man in the line of duty without scrap of hesitation, it was also without a scrap of animosity. That Sergeant Look should signal at the door before entering was further a sign of tact, for he would have been perfectly within his rights to enter without signaling. The two within looked up from their evening meal, and one reached out with his foot to cut off the cracked voice, which rattled out of the battered pocket transmitter with bright liveliness. More books? Asked Lathan Devers. The sergeant held out the tightly wound cylinder of film and scratched his neck. It belongs to Engineer Ori, but he'll have to have it back. He's going to send it to his kids, you know, like what you might call a souvenir, you know. Duke Embar turned the cylinder in his hands with interest. And where did the engineer get it? He hasn't a transmitter also, has he? The sergeant shook his head emphatically. He pointed to the knocked-about remnant at the foot of the bed. That's the only one in the place. This fellow Orr now, he got that book from one of these pigpen worlds out here we captured. They had it in a big building by itself, and he had to kill a few of the natives that tried to stop him from taking it. He looked at it appraisingly. It makes a good souvenir for kids. He paused, then said stealthily, There's big news floating about, by the way. It's only scuttlebutt, but even so, it's too good to keep. The general did it again, and he nodded slowly, gravely. That's so, said Devers. And what did he do? Finish the enclosure, that's all. The sergeant chuckled with a fatherly pride. Didn't he the corker, though? Didn't he work it fine? One of the fellows who's strong on fancy talk says it went as smooth and even as the music of the spheres, whatever they are. The big offensive starts now? Asked Barr mildly. Hope so, was the boisterous response. I want to get back on my ship now that my arm is in one piece again. I'm tired of sitting on my scupper out here. So am I, muttered Devers, suddenly and savagely. There was a bit of underlip caught in his teeth, and he worried it. The sergeant looked at him doubtfully and said, I better go now. The captain's round is due, and I just as soon he didn't catch me in here. He paused at the door. By the way, sir, he said with sudden awkward shyness to the trader, I heard from my wife. She says that little freezer you gave me to send to her works fine. Doesn't cost her anything, and she just about keeps a month's supply of food froze up complete. I appreciate it. It's all right, forget it. The great door moved noiselessly shut behind the grinning sergeant. Duken Barr got out of his chair. Well, he gives us a fair return for the freezer. Let's take a look at this new book. Ah, the title is gone. He unrolled a yard or so of the film and looked through at the light. Then he murmured, Well, skewer me through the scupper, as the sergeant says. This is the Garden of Suma, Devers. That's so, said the trader without interest. He shoved aside what was left of his dinner. Sit down, Barr. Listening to this old-time literature isn't doing me any good. You heard what the sergeant said. Yes, I did. What of it? The offensive will start, and we sit here. Where do you want to sit? You know what I mean. There's no use just waiting. Isn't there? Barr was carefully removing the old film from the transmitter and installing the new. You told me a good deal of Foundation history in the last month, and it seems that the great leaders of past crises did precious little more than sit and wait. Ah, Barr, but they knew where they were going. Did they? I suppose they said they did when it was over, and for all I know, maybe they did. But there's no proof that things would not have worked out as well or better if they had not known where they were going. The deeper economic and sociological forces aren't directed by individual men. Devers sneered. No way of telling that things wouldn't have worked out worse, either. You're arguing tail end backwards. His eyes were brooding. No, suppose I blasted him. Whom? Rios? Yes. Barr sighed. His aging eyes were troubled with the reflection of the long past. Assassination isn't the way out, Devers. I once tried it, under provocation, when I was 20, but it solved nothing. I removed a villain from Siwena, but not the Imperial yoke, and it was the Imperial yoke and not the villain that mattered. But Rios is not just a villain, Doc. He's a whole blamed army. It would fall apart without him. They hang on him like babies. The sergeant out there slobbers every time he mentions him. Even so, there are other armies and other leaders. You must go deeper. There is this Broderick, for instance. No one more than he has the ear of the Emperor. He could demand hundreds of ships where Rios must struggle with 10. I know him by reputation. That so? What about him? The trader's eyes lost in frustration what they gained in sharp interest. You want a pocket outline? He's a low-born rascal who has, by unfailing flattery, tickled the whims of the Emperor. He's well-hated by the court aristocracy, vermin themselves, because he can lay claim to neither family nor humility. He is the Emperor's advisor in all things, and the Emperor's tool in the worst things. He is faithless by choice, but loyal by necessity. There is not a man in the Empire as subtle in villainy or as crude in his pleasures. And they say there is no way to the Emperor's favor but through him, and no way to his but through infamy. Wow. Devers pulled thoughtfully at his neatly trimmed beard. And he's the old boy the Emperor sent out here to keep an eye on Rios. Do you know, I have an idea. I do now. Suppose this Broderick takes a dislike to our young army's delight. He probably has already. He's not noted for a capacity for liking. Suppose it gets really bad. Suppose the Emperor might hear about it and Rios might be in trouble. Quite likely. But how do you propose to get that to happen? I don't know. I suppose he could be bribed. The patrician laughed gently. Yes, in a way, but not in the manner you bribed the sergeant, not with a pocket freezer. And even if you reach his scale, it wouldn't be worth it. There's probably no one so easily bribed, but he lacks even the fundamental honesty of honorable corruption. He doesn't stay bribed, not for any sum. Think of something else. Devers swung a leg over his knee, and his tone nodded quickly and restlessly. It's the first hint, though. He stopped. The door signal was flashing once again, and the sergeant was on the threshold once more. He was excited, and his broad face was red and unsmiling. "Sir," he began, in an agitated attempt at deference, "I am very thankful for the freezer, and you have always spoken to me very fine, although I am only the son of a farmer, and you are great lords." His Pleiadian accent had grown thick, almost too much for easy comprehension, and with excitement, his lumpish peasant derivation wiped out completely the soldierly bearing, so long and so painfully cultivated. Barr said softly, "What is it, Sergeant?" "Lord Broderick is coming to see you tomorrow. I know, because the captain told me to have my men ready for dress review tomorrow for him. I thought I might warn you," Barr said. "Thank you, Sergeant. We appreciate that. But it's all right, man. No need for..." But the look on Sergeant Luke's face was now unmistakably one of fear. He spoke in a rough whisper. "You don't hear the stories the men tell about him. He has sold himself to the space fiend. No, don't laugh. There are most terrible tales told about him. They say he has men with blast guns who follow him everywhere, and when he wants his pleasure, he just tells them to blast down anyone they meet. And they do, and he laughs. They say even the Emperor is in terror of him, and then he forces the Emperor to raise taxes and won't let him listen to the complaints of the people. And he hates the General, that's what they say. And they say he would like to kill the General because the General is so great and wise. But he can't because our General is a match for anyone, and he knows Lord Broderick is a bad un." The Sergeant blinked, smiled in a sudden incongruous shyness at his own outburst, and back toward the door. He nodded his head jerkily. "You mind my words. Watch him." He ducked out. Endeavors looked up hard-eyed. "This breaks things our way, doesn't it, Doc?" "It depends," said Barr dryly. "On Broderick, doesn't it?" But Devers was thinking, not listening. He was thinking hard. Lord Broderick ducked his head as he stepped into the cramped living quarters of the trading ship, and his two armed guards followed quickly, with bared guns and the professionally hard scowls of the hired bravos. The Privy Secretary had little of the look of the lost soul about him just then. If the space fiend had bought him, he had left no visible mark of possession. Rather might Broderick have been considered a breath of court fashion come to enliven the hard, bare ugliness of an army base. The stiff, tight lines of his sheened and immaculate costume gave him the illusion of height, from the very top of which his cold, emotionless eyes stared down the declivity of a long nose at the trader. The mother-of-pearl ruches at his wrists fluttered firmly as he brought his ivory stick to the ground before him and leaned upon it daintily. "No," he said with a little gesture, "you remain here. Forget your toys. I'm not interested in them." He drew forth a chair, dusted it carefully with the iridescent square of fabric attached to the top of his white stick, and seated himself. Devers glanced towards the mate to the chair, but Broderick said lazily, "You will stand in the presence of a peer of the realm." He smiled. Devers shrugged. "If you're not interested in my stock and trade, what am I here for?" The Privy Secretary waited coldly, and Devers added a slow, "Sir." "For privacy," said the Secretary. "Now, is it likely that I would come 200 parsecs through space to inspect trinkets? It's you I want to see." He extracted a small pink tablet from an engraved box and placed it delicately between his teeth. He sucked it slowly and appreciatively. "For instance," he said, "who are you? Are you really a citizen of this barbarian world that is creating all this fury of military frenzy?" Devers nodded gravely. "And you were really captured by him after the beginning of this squabble he calls a war? I am referring to our young general." Devers nodded again. "So, very well, my worthy outlander. I see your fluency of speech is at a minimum. I shall smooth the way for you. It seems that our general here is fighting an apparently meaningless war with frightful transports of energy, and this over a forsaken flea-bite of a world at the end of nowhere, which to a logical man would not seem worth a single blast of a single gun. Yet the general is not illogical. On the contrary, I would say he was extremely intelligent. Do you follow me?" "Can't say I do, sir." The secretary inspected his fingernails and said, "Listen further, then. The general would not waste his men and ships on a sterile feat of glory. I know he talks of glory and of imperial honor, but it is quite obvious that the affectation of being one of the insufferable old demigods of the heroic age won't wash. There is something more than glory here, and he does take queer, unnecessary care of you. Now, if you were my prisoner, and told me as little of use as you have our general, I would slit open your abdomen and strangle you with your own intestines. Devers remained wooden. His eyes moved slightly, first to one of the secretary's bully boys, and then to the other. They were ready, eagerly ready. The secretary smiled. Well, now, you're a silent devil. According to the general, even a psychic probe made no impression. And that was a mistake on his part, by the way, for it convinced me that our young military whiz-bang was lying. He seemed in high humor. My honest tradesman, he said, I have a psychic probe of my own, one that ought to suit you peculiarly well. You see this? And between thumb and forefinger, held negligently, were intricately designed pink and yellow rectangles, which were most definitely obvious in identity. Devers said so. It looks like cash, he said. Cash it is, and the best cash of the Empire, for it is backed by my estates, which are more extensive than the Emperor's own. 100,000 credits, all here, between two fingers. Yours. For what, sir? I'm a good trader, but all trades go in both directions. For what? For the truth. What is the general after? Why is he fighting this war? Lathan Devers sighed and smoothed his beard thoughtfully. What's he after? His eyes were following the motions of the secretary's hands as he counted the money slowly, bill by bill. In a word, the Empire. How ordinary. It always comes to that in the end. But how? What is the road that leads from the galaxy's edge to the peak of Empire so broadly and invitingly? The Foundation, said Devers bitterly, has secrets. They have books, old books, so old that the language therein is only known to a few of the top men. But the secrets are shrouded in ritual and religion, and none may use them. I tried, and now I'm here. And there is a death sentence waiting for me there. I see. And these old secrets. Come, for 100,000 I deserve the intimate details. The transmutation of elements, said Devers shortly. The secretary's eyes narrowed and lost some of their detachment. I have been told that practical transmutation is impossible by the laws of atomics. So it is if atomic forces are used. But the ancients were smart boys. There are sources of power greater than the atoms. If the Foundation used those sources, as I suggested... Devers felt a soft, creeping sensation in his stomach. The bait was dangling. The fish was nosing it. The secretary said suddenly, Continue. The general, I am sure, is aware of all this. But what does he intend doing once he finishes this opera buff affair? Devers kept his voice rock steady. Well, with transmutation, he controls the economy of the whole setup of your empire. Mineral holdings won't be worth a sneeze when Rios can make tungsten out of aluminum and iridium out of iron. An entire production system based on the scarcity of certain elements and the abundance of others is thrown completely out of whack. There'll be the greatest disjointment the empire has ever seen, and only Rios will be able to stop it. And there is the question of this new power I mentioned, the use of which won't give Rios religious heebies. There's nothing that can stop him now. He's got the Foundation by the back of the neck, and once he's finished with it, he'll be emperor in 2 years. So, Broderick laughed lightly. Iridium out of iron. That's what you said, isn't it? Come, I'll tell you a state secret. Do you know that the Foundation has already been in communication with the general?
Devers' back stiffened.
You look surprised. Why not? It seems logical now. They offered him 100 tons of iridium a year to make peace. 100 tons of iron converted to iridium in violation of their religious principles to save their necks. Fair enough. But no wonder our rigidly incorruptible general refused, when he can have the iridium and the empire as well. And poor Cleon called him his one honest general. My bewhiskered merchant, you have earned your money.
He tossed it, and Devers scrambled after the flying bills.
Lord Broderick stopped at the door and turned. One reminder, trader. My playmates with the guns here have neither middle ears, tongues, education, nor intelligence. They can neither hear, speak, write, nor even make sense to a psychic probe. But they are very expert at interesting executions. I have bought you, man, at 100,000 credits. You will be good and worthy merchandise. Should you forget that you are bought at any time and attempt to, say, repeat our conversation to Rios, you will be executed, but executed my way. And in that delicate face, there were sudden hard lines of eager cruelty that changed the studied smile into a red-lipped snarl. For one fleeting second, Devers saw that space fiend who had bought his buyer look out of his buyer's eyes. Silently, he preceded the two thrusting blast guns of Broderick's playmates to his quarters. And to Dukembar's question, he said with brooding satisfaction, "No, that's the queerest part of it. He bribed me." 2 months of difficult war had left their mark on Bel Rios. There was a heavy-handed gravity about him, and he was short-tempered. It was with impatience that he addressed the worshipping Sergeant Luke. "Wait outside, soldier, and conduct these men back to their quarters when I am through. No one is to enter until I call. No one at all, you understand?" The sergeant saluted stiffly out of the room, and Rios, with muttered disgust, scooped up the waiting papers on his desk, threw them into the top drawer, and slammed it shut. "Take seats," he said shortly to the waiting two. "I haven't much time. Strictly speaking, I shouldn't be here at all, but it is necessary to see you." He turned to Dukembar, whose long fingers were caressing with interest the crystal cube in which was set the simulacrum of the lined, austere face of His Imperial Majesty, Cleon II. "In the first place, Patrician," said the general, "your Selden is losing. To be sure, he battles well, for these men of the Foundation swarm like senseless bees and fight like madmen. Every planet is defended viciously, and once taken, every planet heaves so with rebellion, it is as much trouble to hold as to conquer. But they are taken, and they are held. Your Selden is losing."
"But he has not yet lost," murmured Barr politely.
"The Foundation itself retains less optimism. They offer me millions in order that I may not put this Selden to the final test." "So rumor goes." "Ah, is rumor preceding me? Does it prate also of the latest?" "What is the latest?" "Why, that Lord Broderick, the darling of the Emperor, is now second in command at his own request." Devers spoke for the first time. "At his own request, boss? How come? Are you growing to like the fellow?" He chuckled. Rios said calmly, "No, can't say I do. It's just that he bought the office at what I considered a fair and adequate price." "Such as?" "Such as a request to the Emperor for reinforcements." Devers' contemptuous smile broadened. "He has communicated with the Emperor, huh? And I take it, boss, you're just waiting for those reinforcements, but they'll come any day, right?" "Wrong. They have already come. 5 ships of the line, smooth and strong, with a personal message of congratulations from the Emperor, and more ships on the way." "What's wrong, traitor?" he asked sardonically. Devers spoke through suddenly frozen lips. "Nothing." Rios strode out from behind his desk and faced the traitor, hand on the butt of his blast gun. "I say, what's wrong, traitor? The news would seem to disturb you. Surely you have no sudden birth of interest in the Foundation."
"I haven't."
"Yes. There are queer points about you."
"That so, boss?"
Devers smiled tightly and balled the fists in his pockets. "Just you line them up and I'll knock them down for you. Here they are. You were caught easily. You surrendered at first blow with a burnt-out shield. You're quite ready to desert your world, and that without a price. Interesting, all this, isn't it?" "I crave to be on the winning side, boss. I'm a sensible man. You called me that yourself," Rios said with tight throatiness.
"Granted.
Yet no traitor since has been captured. No trade ship but has had the speed to escape a choice. No trade ship but has had a screen that could take all the beating a light cruiser could give it, should it choose to fight. And no traitor but has fought to death when occasion warranted. Traitors have been traced as the leaders and instigators of the guerrilla warfare on occupied planets and of the flying raids in occupied space. Are you the only sensible man, then? You neither fight nor flee, but turn traitor without urging. You are unique, amazingly unique. In fact, suspiciously unique." Devers said softly,
"I take your meaning, but you've got nothing on me. I've been here now 6 months, and I've been a good boy."
This book is continued on cassette number 3.
"So you have, and I have repaid you by good treatment. I have left your ship undisturbed and treated you with every consideration. Yet you fall short. Freely offered information, for instance, on your gadgets might have been helpful. The atomic principles on which they are built would seem to be used in some of the Foundation's nastiest weapons, right?" "I'm only a trader," said Devers, "and not one of these bigwig technicians. I sell this stuff. I don't make it." "Well, that will be seen shortly. It is what I came here for. For instance, your ship will be searched for a personal force shield. You have never worn one, yet all soldiers of the Foundation do. It will be significant evidence that there is information you do not choose to give me, right? There was no answer. He continued, and there will be more direct evidence. I have brought with me the psychic probe. It failed once before, but contact with the enemy is a liberal education. His voice was smoothly threatening, and Devers felt the gun thrust hard in his midriff, the general's gun, hitherto in its holster. The general said quietly, "You will remove your wristband and any other metal ornaments you wear and give them to me. Slowly. Atomic fields can be distorted, you see, and psychic probes might probe only into static." "That's right. I'll take it." The receiver on the general's desk was glowing, and a message capsule clicked into the slot, near which Barr stood and still held the trimensional Imperial bust. Rio stepped behind his desk, with his blast gun held ready. He said to Barr, "You too, Patrician. Your wristband condemns you. You have been helpful earlier, however, and I am not vindictive. But I shall judge the fate of your behostaged family by the results of the psychic probe." And as Rios leaned over to take out the message capsule, Barr lifted the crystal-enveloped bust of Cleon and quietly and methodically brought it down upon the general's head. It happened too suddenly for Devers to grasp. It was as if a sudden demon had grown into the old man. "Out," said Barr, in a tooth-clenched whisper. "Quickly!" He seized Rios's dropped blaster and buried it in his blouse. Sergeant Look turned as they emerged from the narrowest possible crack of the door. Barr said easily, "Lead on, Sergeant." Devers closed the door behind him. Sergeant Look led in silence to their quarters, and then, with the briefest pause, continued onward, for there was the nudge of a blast gun muzzle in his ribs, and a hard voice in his ears which said, "To the trade ship." Devers stepped forward to open the airlock, and Barr said, "Stand where you are, Look. You've been a decent man, and we're not going to kill you." But the sergeant recognized the monogram on the gun. He cried in choked fury, "You've killed the general!" With a wild, incoherent yell, he charged blindly upon the blasting fury of the gun and collapsed in blasted ruin. The trade ship was rising above a dead planet before the signal lights began their eerie blink, and against the creamy cobweb of the great lens in the sky, which was the galaxy, other black forms rose. Devers said grimly, "Hold tight, Barr, and let's see if they've got a ship that can match my speed." He knew they hadn't. And once in open space, the trader's voice seemed lost and dead as he said, "The line I fed Broderick was a little too good. It seems as if he's thrown in with the general." Swiftly, they raced into the depths of the star mass that was the galaxy. Chapter 8. To Trantor. Devers bent over the little dead globe, watching for a tiny sign of life. The directional control was slowly and thoroughly sieving space with its jabbing tight sheaf of signals. Barr watched patiently from his seat on the low cot in the corner. He asked, "No more signs of them? The Empire boys? Nah." The trader growled the words with evident impatience. "We lost the scuppers long ago. Space, with the blind jumps we took through hyperspace, it's lucky we didn't land up in a sun's belly. They couldn't have followed us even if they outranged us, which they didn't." He sat back and loosened his collar with a jerk. "I don't know what those Empire boys have done here. I think some of the gaps are out of alignment." "I take it then you're trying to get to the Foundation?"
"I'm calling the Association, or trying to."
"The Association? Who are they?"
"Association of Independent Traders. Never heard of it, huh? Well, you're not alone. We haven't made our splash yet."
For a while, there was a silence that centered about the unresponsive reception indicator, and Barr said,
"Are you within range?"
"I don't know. I haven't but a small notion where we are, going by dead reckoning. That's why I have to use directional control. It could take years, you know."
"Might it?"
Barr pointed, and Devers jumped and adjusted his earphones. Within the little murky sphere, there was a tiny glowing whiteness. For half an hour, Devers nursed the fragile, groping thread of communication that reached through hyperspace to connect two points that laggard light would take 500 years to bind together. Then he sat back hopelessly. He looked up and shoved the earphones back. "Let's eat, Doc. There's a needle shower you can use if you want to, but go easy on the hot water."